And just so everyone knows, the sessions are being recorded. And so if you don't wish to introduce yourself, if you did have a question, you can send the question through the chat as well. Good morning or good afternoon, Janet.
Hi there. Hi, everyone. So I was asked to talk about step five. Love talking about this step. It says, after this step, we begin to feel the nearness of our creator. That is one of the many beautiful promises of step five. And I'm excited to talk about these promises. But first, I'll tell you just a little bit about me and do a quick, maybe 10-minute run through of steps one through four, so we don't talk about step five in a vacuum. My hope always, always, when I talk, is to convince anyone who's listening that the age of miracles is still with us, that there is a God, and that He is alive and well and launching search and rescue missions for us addicts. So, a little bit about me. I first came into OA when I was in high school. I was already a full-blown compulsive eater. I stole food, I stole money for food, and at my worst, I was binging and purging 6 times a day. I had to have my esophagus surgically retightened because of the abuse I heaped on it. I know sometimes people show pictures. If I was going to show a picture, I'd probably have to like go back through the Walking Dead catalog and find one of those women there, because that was me. I was a Walking Dead person. I was a compulsive liar. I made up crazy stories. I would cut myself with a razor and tell people I'd been mugged. I faked rapes. I went to a hospital once for a fake rape exam and took pills that the very nice nurse gave me so I wouldn't get syphilis from my fake rapist. I was not well physically. I was not stable mentally. And I certainly wasn't well spiritually, even though I believed in God. At one point, I was had been in OA a number of years, still binging, and someone said to me, "If you have such a great relationship with God, why are you still binging?" And I couldn't answer that. And I kept binging for about 7 years in OA while I was going to meetings, while I had sponsors, while I was doing all these assignments, until I was introduced to the God who I believe launched a search and rescue mission for me. And once I committed my life to God, it was like a hand reached in and yanked out the obsession. And this past September 30th, by His grace, was 38 years of being protected by God. And I'm excited to talk about step five and its promises and its role in helping us find God. But first, let me just talk a little bit about the earlier steps so we have some context for step five. I want to say a little bit about powerlessness because this tripped me up for a really long time. And if we don't have a solid foundation at step one, then there's no way we can have a solid two, three, four, five, et cetera. And we'll just be banging our heads wondering why it doesn't work. So let's talk powerlessness. On page 24 of the big book, it says that we are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Well, what does that mean? So they talk about defense and memory, and normally my defense against doing something dangerous is my memory. Let's say I'm about to touch a hot stove. So in my memory are stored all these data points telling me that touching a hot stove is dangerous. So if I'm about to touch a hot stove, my memory will send a little thought running across the bridge that connects to my conscious mind and says, "Stop, danger, hot stoves will burn you." And so I don't touch the stove. Or another example, personal to me, I have a terrible cat allergy. So stored in my memory are a bunch of data points of cat-induced asthma attacks. So if I'm tempted to go into a pet store or visit a friend who has a cat, my memory sends a little thought running across the bridge, that connects to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger, cats will give you an asthma attack. So again, my memory keeps me from danger. So now let's talk food. When I was in college, I used to binge on these certain kind of cookies. I'd always say, I'm just going to have one or two. But we know how that story ended. I would end up eating the whole box and sometimes going out for more of that box of 20. So in my memory were all these data points of how I'd say, I'm just going to eat one, but I'd end up eating the whole box. And so here I am about to buy a box of cookies, telling myself, I'll just have one. And my memory gets ready to generate a little thought to run across the bridge that connects to my conscious mind to say, stop, danger, you won't be able to stop at one. You'll eat the whole box. You'll hate yourself. You'll gain weight. Don't do it. Except when it came to food, the bridge was broken and the thought couldn't get across. The bridge between my memory and my conscious mind was broken. My memory couldn't protect me, and I had no defense against the first compulsive bite. I couldn't keep the memory green. I couldn't just tell myself to stay away from certain trigger foods. I had a broken bridge. And once that bridge is broken, it can never be repaired. I was hopeless. Just like Bill Wilson, right? On page 8, he talked about his hopelessness and said, no words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. For me, food was my master. My bridge was broken. No connection between my memory and my conscious mind when it came to food. And once that bridge is broken, it can never be fixed. Self-knowledge won't fix it. Desire won't fix it. We are 100% hopeless without a miracle. Luckily, this program gives us, all of us, the formula for a miracle. Page 45 tells me that lack of power is my problem. And then it tells me what my solution is. And it doesn't say the solution is meetings or food plans or fellowships. Those are all wonderful, but that's not the solution with a capital S. The solution is to find a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. Those are really powerful words if we think about it. The solution is to find a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. So let's play detective. We see the big book gives us our first clues about how to find this power greater than me, which will solve my problem. Well, if it's going to solve my problem, this power must be pretty smart, because I certainly couldn't figure out how to do it. And I have 2 master degrees. This power must also be strong, because this illness kicked my butt. So this power must be stronger than me and must be stronger than this illness. And finally, and most important, this power must care about me. Otherwise, why would he bother trying to solve my problem? So smart, strong, and cares about me. That's a power. That's a God who I'm interested in having a relationship. Okay, so we have some clues about God. Smart, strong, cares about me. And on page 55 of the big book, it gives us some more clues. And I love this. I'm going to just read this. It's the second paragraph. It says, deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship of other things, but in some form or other, it is there. That is so cool. Deep down in all of us is the fundamental idea of God. That means God loved me so much that when he created me, along with like 2 lungs, 2 kidneys, 1 heart, he put the fundamental idea of himself inside of me. It's there. Now it says it can be blocked. It's like spiritual cataracts by calamity, by pomp, and by worship of other things. We don't have time to go into them now, but suffice it to say that it's step 2 we need to get rid of our spiritual cataracts. And then our book tells us on page 53 that reason brings us so far. So we've gone so far. What do we do after we've gathered all our clues? For me, it started with a prayer. Now, why pray? Well, prayer is the currency in the spiritual world. In the physical world, if I want to get a bag of groceries or a tank of gas, I hand the clerk a $20 bill. Money is the currency in the spiritual world. But obviously, I can't hand God a 20 and ask for power over my food obsession. Currency in the spiritual world is prayer. So I prayed. And this was my prayer. I said, God, I've always had fixed ideas of what you were like and how to worship you. I'm willing to admit it's all wrong and to start over and let you show me what you're like and how to worship you. And that was really my step three, where I surrendered my life to God. On a practical note, what does surrender look like? It means I get out of the outcome business. I no longer do things to get a result. Well, I try not to. I mess up a whole bunch. That's why I have a 10 step, but someone else is talking about that. But it means basically I try to be obedient to God. So for example, I may have a desire that my kids who are now 19 and 20 go to church while they're in college. I can have a desire. I mean, we're human and God created us to have desires. But I can't have demands and I can't have that or anything else as my numero uno goal. So I just do what I think God would have me. I take them to church when they're little. I try to model good behavior, but whether or not they go to church now while they're in college is none of my business. I don't even ask them anymore. And I believe God won't judge my success in life by whether I've raised church-going kids, even though I think that's important. He'll just look at my obedience to him. And living that way is the only way I know how to stay sane. Very few things are any of my business, and that makes life easier. So then I did my fourth step, looked at my defects, my resentments, and especially at how I was wrong. Remember, our big book tells us that if we harbor resentments, if I'm a safe harbor for resentments to park themselves in, I'm cut off from the sunlight of the spirit. My only hope of recovery, remember, is being protected by God. So if I'm cut off from God, I am in trouble. It's like being cut off from my oxygen supply, my spiritual oxygen supply. So I had to resolve my resentments. And the main thing I had to do was look to see my part, which wasn't just saying, this person is spiritually sick and my part is to pray for them. If I'm angry, I've got a part. And then I looked at my fears. I love how the big book talks about fears. It says fear is an evil and corroding thread. Evil. So I had to look at the reasons for all my fears. And when I drilled down, I always found that I didn't want to be sad or I didn't want to be uncomfortable. But this program tells me and then teaches me how to live with discomfort. So for example, if I had a fear my kids wouldn't go to college, I would analyze it by saying, if they don't go to college, they won't get good jobs. If they don't get good jobs, they'll have horrible lives. If they have horrible lives, I'll be sad. Well, a bit of dishonest thinking there, right? My playing God mind says that if they don't go to college, they'll have a horrible life. And my playing God mind says that if my kids are unhappy, I'll be unhappy. So I have to root that out, ask God to remove those fears, show me what he would have me do. In this case, model good behavior and pray. And by the way, my kids are both going to college. The jury's still out on whether or not they'll go to church. None of my business. We finish up our step fours with an analysis of harms, past relationships, and we craft a sex ideal. And now we are ready for step five. So the first paragraph on page 72 of our big books is such a cool paragraph. It tells me why I have to do a fifth step. And it gives me three reasons. The first reason, I'm trying to get a new attitude. Definitely trying to change, to not be such a self-centered, selfish person. But look at the second reason. I'm trying to get a new relationship with my creator. See, this program isn't about believing in God. It's about having a relationship with him. And this step is going to help me with that. And then the third reason, to help me with the obstacles in my path. What are the character defects that are blocking me from my new relationship with my creator? And it says, I've already started to see what my defects were, right? In step four, now they're about to be cast out. Notice that wording. They're about to be cast out. Passive voice. I don't do the casting out. God does. That's how it works. I look at my defects. I admit them. But then he removes them. I think we read and hear these words so often, it's easy to miss out on like the awesomeness of it all. These are my defects that I caused, a big wall that I've built between myself and God. But what does God do? Does he say, well, you built this wall, you caused this mess, so you clean it up yourself? He doesn't. He doesn't. He says, he comes in with a broom and a mop to help me clean it up. I mean, he just keeps proving his love over and over. In the next paragraph, they tell us another super duper important reason why we can't skip this step. If we skip this step, we may not overcome drinking. We may not stop binging. The text says that when people try to avoid this humbling experience, almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of this program, they wondered why they fell. So how come they fell? Well, by not disclosing everything, they were dishonest. And yes, dishonesty by omission is still dishonesty. At the top of page 73, it says, these people wondered why they fell. A person should always know, right, if they go into relapse, what caused it. Not doing a thorough fifth step is a cause of relapse. The AA 12 and 12 goes into a great deal of this if you want to read about it. It's on pages 55 to 57. And after talking about all the different consequences of avoiding step five, including irritability, anxiety, remorse, and depression, they conclude by saying that most of us would declare that without a fearless admission of our defects to another human being, we could not stay sober. It seems plain that the grace of God will not enter to expel our destructive obsessions until we're willing to try this. That's a strong statement, but let's not miss that beautiful imagery there. The grace of God enters to expel my destructive obsessions. What a cool image, right? God just comes in and kicks out the illness, just chases out the food obsession the way a woman with a broom might tell a cat to skedaddle, right? That's how strong God is. And as a side note, it's always important for me to remember that it's the grace of God that gets rid of the obsession, not any hard work that I do. It's as if there's a raging hurricane and my house is flooded and there's a helicopter that's coming to rescue stranded people. My job is to get to the roof so that the helicopter can rescue me. But I can't just say, pick me up at the front door, then I'll drown. But also let me never be so arrogant as to say that I rescued myself. All I did was climb up those 12 steps to the roof so that I was in a position to be rescued. So back to our big book. Continuing on page 73, they say that more than most people, we live double lives. We're like actors. To the outer world, we present our stage character. We want to enjoy a certain reputation, but know in our hearts, we don't deserve it. So we've got this guilt. And guilt is only helpful if it encourages us to really admit our character defects. if I take $50 from your wallet and I feel guilty, well, I should feel guilty. Then my conscience is doing its job. But that guilt is only helpful if I go to you and confess and give you your $50 back. But often we just carry around a vague sense of guilt and we just beat ourselves up and feel like crap. And we call that humility. It isn't humility. The book goes on to say that the alcoholic, or for us, the compulsive eater, is revolted by what he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. We can't be vague. We can't have these boogeymen in the closet. We can say, I think I sort of kind of did some not very nice things in my past. We can't go to God like that. I need to go to God and say, I faked a mugging here. I lied here. I cheated here. I stole from Susie. I was nasty to Sally. Here's what I did. I need to be specific. Why? Because if we don't get these things out, the big book tells us we end up pushing these memories far inside ourselves, which leads to constant fear and tension, which leads to drinking or binging. Fear and tension, mental and emotional drain. Then the chapter continues by saying that psychologists generally don't work for us because we are generally not honest with them. And they keep hammering home honesty in that big book, saying we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long and happily in this world. So I want to say a few things about honesty. Basically, if we're not honest, we aren't going to recover. It doesn't matter how many meetings we go to. It doesn't matter how our food plan is, how many phone calls we make. If we're not honest, it's like we took a big black magic marker and wrote the words, keep out God, across our hearts. God won't come in where there's dishonesty. Ways we're often dishonest is with our sponsors, right? Often about food, we lie by omission when we don't tell them things we know that they should know. Or even not about food, we know the things we should talk about. And think about it. If I'm not honest with my sponsor, what I've done is make an idol. I've made a false god out of my sponsor, thinking that having a good relationship with my sponsor is what's going to get me recovered. But a sponsor's job is to help me get a relationship with God. I'm actually better off being honest with no sponsor than being dishonest with a sponsor. And if I'm dishonest with my sponsor, I'm really stealing from her because I'm stealing her time. She can go out and work with somebody who means business. So we're people who have to be honest. Whether or not earth people have to be honest, I don't know. None of my business. But for people like us, it means no lying, no cheating on husbands, no cheating on taxes. We are people who have to live in a way that's rigorously honest. I'm going to flip over to the AA 12 and 12 for a bit. I'm on page 60, where it says that until we actually sit down and talk aloud about what we have so long hidden, our willingness to clean house is still largely theoretical. When we're honest with another person, it confirms that we've been honest with ourselves and with God. So now they're talking about honesty, but they go even further than that. They continue by saying that going it alone in spiritual matters is dangerous. Sure, it's a lot easier for me to just go to God and say, God, I faked a mugging and I'm sorry, than to tell another person. It's harder because there's fear. What if my sponsor doesn't like me? What if she judges me? And by the way, as an aside, a sponsor needs to always, always make sure that the sponsee feels safe enough to confide anything, to let their sponsees know that anything they tell them goes to the grave with them. And we're not judges. This way, our sponsees can feel safe. And just as an aside, while a lot of us are sponsoring long distance, I find it's really helpful to do the fifth step and most step work by FaceTime or Skype or Zoom. I think a deeper bond can be formed between sponsee and sponsor if we can at least see each other, even if we can't be in the same room, and it helps the sponsee feel safe and cared for. So let's back to the 12 and 12 again, page 60. It says, it is worth noting that people of very high spiritual development almost always insist on checking with friends or spiritual advisors the guidance they feel they have received from God. Surely then a novice ought not lay himself open to the chance of making foolish, perhaps tragic blunders. While the comment or advice of others may be by no means infallible, it's likely to be far more specific than any direct guidance we may receive while we're still so inexperienced in establishing contact with a power greater than ourselves. Wait, look at those words. Establishing contact with a power greater than ourselves. To me, that's mind-boggling. The power that flung the stars into the sky wants to have contact with me, wants a relationship with me. And at step five, I'm truly on my way. The 12 and 12 says the next thing we're to do is find the right person to do this with. Generally, it's someone who's done this work before, usually our sponsor, but there's some caveats that the big book makes. It says we can do our fifth step with a member of our family, but we can't disclose anything to them which will hurt them and make them unhappy. We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. And I think that's a rule for both the fifth step and for life. I have no right to save my own skin at another person's expense. Another rule that comes out here, we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. Being hard on ourselves gets a bad rap, but it's actually necessary in the sense of being ruthless about admitting our character defects and admitting where we're wrong. We have to go to God and really be honest about what we've done wrong. I think that's what it means to be hard on ourselves. We don't sweep anything under the rug. So back to the big book, last paragraph on page 74. If you're ever in a big book trivia contest and they ask you what's the only step you're allowed to postpone, the answer is step five, but only if there isn't a suitable person around. As soon as there is, we need to be ready. And it tells us the qualities of that person. It's important that they're able to keep a confidence and that they understand and approve what we're doing. Once we have the right person, we go to it and hold nothing back. It says on page 75 that we pocket our pride, and boy, do we have to put our pride in our pockets. But then the promises, and these are some gorgeous promises. But just like I didn't want to talk about step five in a vacuum, I don't really want to talk about the fifth step promises in a vacuum because it's really cool to see the progression of the promises of this program. The first promises are with step two. There are no step one promises. I'm just admitting I'm powerless and my life is unmanageable. It's as if I went to a doctor and admitted I had diabetes. Okay, I admitted it. But just admitting it, nothing changes. Remember, the big book tells us lack of power is our problem. So, what I need to get better is power. These steps are a continuum. We start out with no power, and with each step, we keep getting more and more power until we're through the first nine steps. And we've got all the access to power that this program gives us to have power over the food. But on page 46, it talks about getting our first infusion of power with step two. It says, as soon as we admit the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe underlying the totality of things, we begin, again, we're just beginning here, we begin to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided we take other simple steps. So once I say, maybe there is a God, and maybe this God can help me, I start getting power, just enough power and direction to get me to step three. And then step three, the top of page 63 gives me more promises. This is when I decide, not only do I believe in you, God, but I'm going to do whatever you want as best I can. It says we have a new employer with a capital E, so meaning God. Being all powerful, he provides what we need if. So when we say see the word if, we know it's a conditional promise. I have to do certain things. If we keep close to him and perform his work well. And then it says, established on this footing, the footing of giving our lives to God, deciding to do his will, we automatically get less and less interested in ourselves. So the spiritual experience is starting here. A spiritual experience is when God rewires my heart to make me more like him. So instead of being selfish and self-centered like Janet is on her own, I become more tolerant, more loving like my creator is. We become less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. We become more interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. And now listen to this. As we felt new power flow in, so now we're getting even more power. We got a little bit in step two. We get a little bit more in step three. And also it says, we enjoy peace of mind. We discover we can face life successfully and we become conscious of God's presence. That means we start realizing, oh yeah, there really is a God. And he's not just like some abstract thing. He's here, not just up in the cloud somewhere. He didn't just create the universe and then decide to spend the rest of eternity watching Netflix. And it says we begin to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We're reborn. Then the four-step promises on the bottom of page 70 says, we've now begun to comprehend the terrible destructiveness and resentments and begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies. And on page 75, it says that they hope, the founders of this program hope, that we're now convinced that God can remove the self-will that blocks us, that creates a block between us and him. So now we go beyond belief. Now we have trust. And there's something here that sounds yucky, but that's actually really cool. The last line of chapter 5 promises that if we've done this right, we've swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about ourselves. Not fun. But of course, only by doing that can we proceed to step 5. And it's glorious promises, and they are glorious. After step 5, we're told that we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. That was my experience. I felt as if I'd been nearsighted all my life and someone just gave me a pair of glasses. Trees just looked greener. That's the best way I could describe it. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. What a great visual that is. I was recently in Aruba and we would come up from the beach and brush off our bathing suits and the sand would just fall from us. Imagine that, our fears falling from us like sand. And then this, we begin to feel the nearness of our creator. So not just in awareness, we feel, it's not just intellectual, we feel him near us. Whether I'm going through stress or surgery or the pain of rejection, God is near me. I was never a true agnostic. I always believed in God, but I was a practical agnostic. That knowledge did nothing for me. If I were a diabetic and believed that insulin could help me, but never injected it into my arm, it would do me no good. So it says we had beliefs before, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. God is rewiring our hearts. The feeling that the drink problem, or for us, the food problem, has disappeared will often come strongly. Disappeared, gone. Often, I take that to mean more than 50% of the time, we're not obsessing about food. We're not thinking about food. We feel we're on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. Oh, and by the way, if you think that's awesome, just wait until you finish step 9, where it tells us we will seldom, that means hardly ever, be interested in liquor or food not on our food plans. And when we're tempted, we recoil automatically. So stick around for the deepening of the miracle. The 12 and 12 has some more fifth step promises that were really cool. On page 57, it tells us that people who are tortured, that we are people who are tortured by loneliness. And with this step, we begin to get rid of that loneliness. Oh yes, the book tells us, the fellowship helps us in a social sense, but even with the fellowship, we still suffered many of the old pains of anxious apartness. That was me. I could be in a room with all of you and feel like I was the only person on the planet. What's the solution? Well, the 12 and 12 states the answer so clearly. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of true kinship with man and God. And the promises keep coming, guys. On page 58 of the AA 12 and 12, it says, we began to get the feeling that we could be forgiven no matter what we had thought and done. When I'm telling my sponsor or my 10-step partner or a fellow all the horrible things I've thought and done, and yes, I still sometimes think and do horrible things, and that person looks at me or speaks at me with love, just like they did before, I start to feel maybe I can be forgiven. And it also tells us that it's often while working on step 5 that we first felt truly able to forgive others. So we start knowing that we can receive forgiveness and give forgiveness. So another thing, on page 58, it tells us we start getting more humility. And I love the definition there. They define humility as a clear recognition of what and who we really are, followed by a sincere attempt to become what we could. Isn't that pretty? Then page 59 of the 12 and 12 has another promise. See, they just keep coming in this program. It says that only by discussing ourselves, holding back nothing, only by being willing to take advice and accept direction, could we set foot on the road to straight thinking, solid honesty, and genuine humility. Pretty interesting, straight thinking. But of course, in chapter 5 of the big book, it says that once the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. So by me doing this spiritual work, my thinking starts to straighten out. And step 5 in the AA 12 and 12 ends with this. This feeling of being at one with God and man, this emerging from isolation through the open and honest sharing of our terrible burden of guilt, brings us to a resting place where we may prepare ourselves for the following steps toward a full and meaningful sobriety. Interesting, that word, toward. We get to a point where we're no longer running from food. We're running toward a full and meaningful sobriety, toward an ever-deepening love relationship with God, toward an ability to be more useful to others. I'm not running from anymore. I'm running toward. But if there is someone who's sitting here today who isn't sure what to do, who knows they're powerless, but isn't sure how to get started, I think it's okay to start with a maybe prayer. And it might go something like this. God, I don't know if you're there. And if you're there, I don't know if you care about me. But if you're there, and if you care, please help me. The worst thing that could happen is that you're talking to dead air. But what if there really is a God? What if there is? And what if that prayer is the currency, the catalyst that allows God to start a renovation project in our hearts so that we have a spiritual experience, so that he begins to rewire our souls in such a way that our plans and priorities become more like his plans and priorities. And when that happens, the food obsession doesn't stand a chance, because really and truly, when we work these steps, the age of miracles is still with us. And with that, I pass.
Are you going to do a Q&A, Janet?
Sure.
Okay, so if anyone has questions for Janet, oh, my camera's not on. If anyone has questions for Janet, please raise your hand. Thank you, Janet. You are just so encompassing. There's no questions.
I have a question.
Okay, Susan.
Janet, thank you for your share. Can you speak to a little bit about the impediments for perhaps for people who have left a little bit back and don't quite know what might happen if they aren't radically honest in this step?
Sure. The impediments to a block of So this, in trying to find God, I think the chapter We Agnostic talks about how we have to lay aside prejudices on page 49. And there's five or six different prejudices. Let me try and remember them all. The concept of God we were raised with doesn't work. We think if we believe in God, it makes us weak. If I really believe in God, I can't do what I want. People who say they believe in God aren't very nice. If there was a God, why would he allow such bad things to happen? And I can't remember the last one. But so those are things we have to work through. And then on page 55, it talks about three other things: spiritual cataracts, calamity, pomp, worship of other things. Calamity is what Bill Wilson was, one of his impediments that he talked about on page 11. He said he believed in God, but he said, judging what I had seen in Europe and since in the war, the power of God in human affairs was negligible. He talks about war, chicanery, and he goes so far as to say, if there was a devil, he seemed the boss. So some of us might say, if there was a God, why would he allow human trafficking? Why would he allow this person to die of cancer? You know, these things bother us. If there was a God, how could that happen? And the answer that Ebby, the man who 12-stepped Bill Wilson, said, is he just listened. He didn't debate. And he just said, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. My human will had failed. When I admitted defeat, God raised me and helped me, took away the obsession. So these are the things we can like put over in a bucket of like things we don't know and can't understand, and we'll ask God after we die. I have that in my bucket of questions, along with, did OJ really do it? Calamity. So pomp. That means me thinking that the world needs to revolve around me, that the sun, moon, stars, and all the people here need to do my will. My kids need to go to church so I'll be happy. My husband needs to quit smoking so I'll feel safe. That's all pomp. Uh-uh. No. People don't have to change for me to be okay. And worship of other things. My job. You know, people, these are really our idols. And we can tell what our worship of other things are if we say, I won't be happy unless I get married, unless I have kids, unless I have that promotion, unless my kids, you know, do what I want them to. Whatever our unless is, that's our worship of other things. So in order to get to God, we need to look at our prejudices and our spiritual cataracts. Thanks. That was a great question.
Thanks, Janet. All right, so we have Jessica. Jessica, go ahead and ask Janet your question.
Okay, hi Janet. This is Jessica, compulsive
Hi.
overeater. Yeah, hi. My question is that I'm struggling to oh my God, how do or where do I assign step five to my sponsees? Because it's like I tell them to prepare for the four step inventory, and then normally I would summarize five to them, and then we'll go do step six. So I'm kind of confused by that. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, I would say the beginning of interaction talks all about step five, and you can ask them to read it or read it with them. And then in the AA 12 and 12, the whole step five is a wonderful chapter, chock full of great words of wisdom.
So do I do that after they completed the four step inventory or before the like the timing of it?
Yeah, I would say after they're done with step four, before you sit down with them, you can ask them to read it or read it with them.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks for the question, Jessica. Go ahead, Ev.
Thank you, Janet. I'm a black and white person and I like take notes, and you were really fast. I didn't catch the page number of the second step promises. If you would give that to me again.
46.
Thank you, and thank you very much for all your experience.
All right, so we have Janet for about, well, looks like about 15, less than 15 minutes. Oh, we have more questions. Jessica, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Jessica C, a recovered compulsive eater. I'm in Ontario. Janet, you mentioned idols, and I realized that I've made an idol out of my job. I put my job on my resentment as one of my resentments for my step five, and I do a lot of step 10 work and six and seven work on my job, and it just keeps coming up for me. You mentioned that, becoming aware of our spiritual cataracts is a way to get closer to God. So is there anything else, like any other sort of guidance that you would suggest in this area?
Yeah, two things. So the first thing, idolatry, let's just treat it like a defect, right? So you can inventory the ways it manifests and then ask God to remove it, right? Dear God, please remove my idolatry and help me put you on the throne. And then just like we craft sex ideals, you can craft a job ideal that would keep your job in its perfect place. So for instance, it might be for me, one thing I have is I've told my boss I won't look at work emails on Sundays. Like that's my Sabbath. So and that's my way of keeping my job in its proper place. So you have to figure out like for you, what's the way to make it not be an idol? So it may be, you turn off your phone after a certain time. Or if you're worried about what your boss thinks about you just keep reminding yourself that like what other people think of me is none of my business, and you work for God. Oh, and I just thought of a third thing. This might help. This is when I first started in recovery. I was like a baby in recovery, and I had this very stressful job. My job was to place home attendance with elderly people like on Medicare. So I was getting calls all day long with people who, my home attendant's poisoning my green beans, and someone else like, where's my check? And it was just very like there was a lot going on. So I made up this game for myself, right? Because recovery is like more fun when it's fun. And I pretended that God had my job. But this day, he couldn't show up to work because he was busy with like war and poverty and children starving in Ethiopia. So my assignment was to go to work at his job and not let anyone know it was me and not him. So when I would get a call, I would say, okay, God would treat each person with like perfect patience, like they were the only person there. And so I would do it like that, and to make kind of a game of it. So those are three things that might help you.
Thanks, Janet.
Okay.
Thanks, Janet. All right, Anne W., go ahead and ask your question. Oh, you're muted, Anne.
Yeah. Thanks so much for sharing, Janet. That was really helpful. I just wanted to hear a little bit more about when you would hear somebody's fifth step. And in a perfect world, I know we work with our sponsees and they will kind of work back and forth on the fourth step. And I was just thinking there's been situations where I've been given a fifth step that I hadn't had any prior involvement with. And I know it's not a format that's going to bring out maybe what the person could best, you know, get help from. How do you handle those situations? How much feedback do you give during the fifth step?
A lot. So first, as they're doing their fourth step, I kind of check in to make sure that they're doing it properly. But during the fifth step, I give a lot. When they say their part, if, you know, I help them if they need help seeing their part, help them if they need help seeing their defects. So yeah, I give a lot of feedback. Otherwise, yeah, it's not going to be as helpful to them. So yeah, I give a lot.
Do you ever say to a person, you need to do this differently, go away and come back?
Sometimes, but ideally, as they're doing their fourth step, I check in. So let's say they've done they're on their resentment inventory. After they've done a couple, I'll say, okay, let's go over a couple to make sure, you know, you're on the right track. So this, that's a better way to do it, so that they're not there prepared to do the fifth step. And after 10 minutes, it's like, you know, sorry, you need to go home and start over. Mm-hmm. So I try to check in as they're doing it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Janet. All right, guys, we have about 8 minutes left with Janet. If there's any other questions, great opportunity. Teresa, go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Teresa, compulsive overeater from Edmonton. Janet, the last speaker spoke about only giving his sponsees a day. How long do you give a sponsee to work on their fourth step before you want to hear their fifth step? Or do you have a time frame and let them guide their own recovery?
So I go by the big book, and it says we put forth a strenuous effort, a vigorous effort. Otherwise, we're in danger of losing our abstinence. So I caution them about that, and I pretty much tell them, like, when you're not working or sleeping or, you know, taking care of your health and your family responsibilities, you should pretty much be working on your fourth step. But no, I don't tell people they have a day. I don't know who the speaker was. I'm not saying it's wrong. The big book doesn't give a time frame. So I just use the guidelines that the big book gives, which is a strenuous effort.
Thank you, Janet. Donna B.
Hi, Brandy. It's nice to see your face. Yeah. Hi, Janet. Hi. This is also kind of a step four question. Somebody reached out to me the other day seeking my counsel, and I didn't really have an answer. The question was, when assigning step four, should you ask the sponsee to write on every resentment ever, 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 just the resentments that are currently still sticky? And I've even heard a sponsor who says, just write on your top 10 biggest current resentments because the patterns will be revealed in those 10. Thank you.
The second, I say, if there's a resentment that even if it happened yesterday and it's resolved and you don't have it, doesn't go on the list. If you have a resentment, even if it's from kindergarten and you still have it, it goes on the list, because we're dealing with, like, remember, the goal is to see what's blocking me from God. And so any current resentment is blocking me from God. If it's been resolved, it's not blocking me. And if I've, and the goal isn't to find patterns, in my opinion. Again, I may be wrong, but this is how I read the book. The goal is to get rid of all the resentments blocking me from God. So I would go with option two.
Oh, go ahead, Diane.
Hi, I'm Diane, a compulsive reader. Janet, thank you very much for your share. That was awesome. I really like the promises from the OA Big Book. I need to pick them out that way. I'm just wondering for sometimes I've heard people are living in step nine when they're in step five. And how? What's your recommendation? Because even for myself, I have been in a place where I'm afraid to do step five because I have to do step nine. How do you keep yourself from living in having to, I worry about the outcome.
So it's like, we have to stay in the day, right? We have to, so by the time, when I met the person who carried the message to me, she told me to go read the text section of the book. And to say, was I willing to do it all? And I said, there's this one amend I'm not willing to make. And she said, are you willing to trust that by the time you get to step nine, you'll be a different person? And I said, okay. So I guess that's what I would say to you. So much change happens. I mean, step five, lots of change. Step seven, our defects get removed. And then we even have step eight. Step eight isn't just making a list. But actually, half of step eight is becoming willing to make our amends. So I would say work on whatever step you're on with all your might and trust the process that by the time you get there, God will give you whatever you need to be able to make that amend. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you, Janet. All right. So we have a couple more minutes, probably not enough time for questions. Maybe if you want to take a 2-minute break, chat amongst yourselves, and then we'll bring on the next speaker for step seven.